Apostasy, the act of leaving one's religion, is the issue under investigation now by Shiraz Mir in Could I Stop Being a Muslim?
Some people call me an apostate, and most of them will tell you that in Islam, the punishment for apostasy is death.
Maybe a beheading, or a hanging, or he is crucified. It's left to the discretion of the judge.
It was either you come back to Islam or you leave, because we can't have a Christian living under our roof.
They said, well, go away, you're not our son anymore. They told people I died in an accident rather than having the shame.
My mum called the emergency doctor because they thought I'd gone mad.
There are certain conditions that need to be fulfilled, that they were not somehow insane or they were intoxicated at the time, because all of these are barriers for the ruling of execution.
An apostate, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is one who abjures or forsakes his religious faith. Well, that's not me. I haven't stopped believing in Islam. But extreme Muslims accuse those of us who say we're proud to be British of abandoning the faith.
Life in prison for the Birmingham man who planned to kidnap and behead a Muslim serving in the British Army.
Earlier this year, a group of men who lived just a few miles from where I was raised in Birmingham were convicted of a plot to kidnap and behead a Muslim serving in the British Army. For extremists, any Muslim who fights for Britain is an apostate.
He was recorded telling Basiru Gassama how he planned to remove the soldier's head Baghdad style while videoing the whole thing. You cut it off like you cut a pig, then you put it on a stick, and we say this to all Muslimi: join the Kufr army, this is what will happen to you.
The Oxford English Dictionary has a second definition of apostasy, and it's this: one who deserts his party or forsakes his allegiance or troth. A turncoat, a renegade. The extremists think that's the sort of apostate I am. For 4 years, I was a member of the radical Islamist group Hizb ut-Tahrir. But because I now say Muslims should integrate into British life and help the authorities counter terrorism, I've been labelled a traitor.
Anyone who cooperates with the Muslim Council of Britain to cooperate with the police to arrest their fellow Muslims is committing an act of apostasy.
It's Al-Qaeda's philosophy spread on British soil. But how valid is its claim to have its roots in Islam? Is apostasy from the Muslim faith political or religious or both? Is death really the penalty? And could I, if I wanted to, stop being a Muslim?
She said, you're not even denying it, you're not even saying that you are a Muslim anymore. And then continually, my mum is saying, we can't have a Christian living under our roof. We can't do this. This is against everything we believe in.
They came to a decision within our family that I should choose between my new faith or my family.
Safiya Alam, not her real name, and Zia Miral, consciously chose to leave Islam and convert to Christianity. A month ago, a prominent Egyptian journalist, Magdi Alam, also converted and was baptized by the Pope in St. Peter's Basilica during the Vatican's Easter service. His high-profile conversion and criticism of Islam have caused controversy, but any Muslim who chooses to leave the faith is breaking a genuine taboo. Many have encountered lots of problems as a result of their decision.
My mum called the emergency doctor because they thought I'd gone mad, and the emergency doctor came and just said, everything's fine. This is a domestic problem that you're having here. There's nothing wrong with you. And then he writ out some numbers for me in case I needed them, like a refuge centre or something. And then the family came, and the family put me on the spot. My uncles and my aunts. And they all told me to renounce within 7 days. And then there's lots of threats.
What kinds of threats?
They said that this is a crime that you've done and it's punishable by death. That really scared me.
Sophia's experience isn't uncommon, and neither are the threats. A poll conducted by the Policy Exchange in 2007 suggested that over a third of young British Muslims believe in the death penalty for apostasy. That may be because many young Muslims have never been exposed to the pluralism and diversity of Islamic thought. But the fact is, until quite recently, I too used to believe the penalty for apostasy was death. Sophia never believed her life was in actual danger, but the situation she faced was still so unbearable that she was eventually forced into hiding. She thinks her family finally managed to find out through a taxi company that she'd been attending a local church, Her mother turned up there on the morning of Sophia's baptism.
My name was called up and I gave a little speech and basically turned around and got ready to be baptised. And that's when my mum got up and she came running to the front to pull me out of the water. She was screaming and shouting at me. She was talking to me in Urdu and Punjabi right now. She was just saying that, how can you do this? You've turned your back on your dad. You've turned your back on me. I'm your mother. I gave you birth. How can you reject me? And I was just saying, Mama. But I was in the middle of doing my baptism and it was such an awful moment. Now, I mean, in hindsight, I look at it and I was thinking, oh, it should have been a special moment. There should have been lovely music. And to be honest, in all fairness, that's not how the disciples of Christ were baptized. I mean, when I look at their stories, I thought it's quite similar. Yeah. You know, they were slandered. Yeah, they had difficult times. And I just remember at that point when Pastor Tony had his hands on my ears because he was praying for me. But the foul language that my mum was using, my mum must have gone back, told my dad, told my brother. My brother was really angry. He was very young, though. He was very young teenager. He naturally reacted and phoned me on this mobile and just said, I'm coming down to burn that church.
Zia Moral can relate to Sophia's difficulties. He was brought up as a Muslim in Turkey and converted to Christianity while studying at university. He planned to tell his parents during the holidays and knew it would be a difficult moment. Before heading home, Zia visited a Christian summer camp where his plans to break the news gently to his parents were overtaken by events.
This Turkish TV channel drew into the campsite and recorded me and my friends. And for the next 2 weeks, we were on nationwide news. Me eating a bowl of spaghetti and we were declared as missionaries, brainwashing our children. This was all Christian children, and I was not a missionary, and I'm not a missionary. But of course, it was packaged and shown to the Turkish society as, here it is, this vicious little camp seducing Muslim youth. So then my poor family, actually, who didn't even know I was attending a church, let alone I was a Christian, learned with the rest of the country.
Wow.
On a TV program.
And what was their reaction to that?
They were really disappointed, and eventually they said, well, go away, you're not our son anymore. They told people I died in an accident rather than having the shame.
I find myself to be one of the lucky ones in many aspects, that they haven't completely, no, we don't ever want to see you again, you're completely dead for us. You know, that stage hasn't yet happened. But I always feel we're on the verge of that, because despite me trying to be loving, to be still my dad's daughter and still trying to mingle with the family at large, going to functions, I'm still so excluded. But then I read in a psalm, when my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take care of me. I just thought, okay, whatever happens, it'll be okay.
Sophia and Zia come from very different backgrounds. Sophia told us that her father prayed 5 times a day and that, as a child, she read the Quran on a daily basis. By contrast, Zia's family are not practicing and are avowedly secular. Why did his family, as people who weren't that religious, react so extremely? Zia tried to put this into context.
Let me give you an explanation through my sister. My oldest sister, she drives a 2-door sports car. She just dresses up like anybody else in London. She practices Zen Buddhism. She admires Jean-Paul Sartre. And she continually reads New Age books and self-help books. And she's a Muslim. And everybody's okay with it. So she might be a bad Muslim for those that are really dedicated, but she's still a Muslim. In the West, for us, religious beliefs are personal beliefs. This is between me and God. Whereas and identities in the Middle East are not constructed through personal actualization. For example, in the UK, I become who I am by achieving things, maximizing my potential. Whereas in my part of the world, it isn't just about how great I am personally, but it is how I am perceived by my community.
Similar forces are at play in Britain among the largely South Asian Muslim community, where many feel a need to preserve family honour. There seems to be a strong sense of betrayal, and even disgust, when someone leaves Islam for another faith. It seems to be a feeling almost entirely divorced from how religious you actually are. Sophia told us that although her father is an observant Muslim, her mother is not. And yet it was her mother who turned up at the church, and who was most abusive towards her when she finally converted. But I think it's too easy to just dismiss this as a cultural problem. I want to ask some difficult questions about the texts which serve as the basis for Islamic law, and see where this idea springs from within Islam itself.
The Quran actually doesn't specify any mandatory punishment for somebody who leaves Islam whatsoever.
Haris Rafiq is the leader of the Sufi Muslim Council, a movement which emphasizes traditional Islam. If he thinks the Quran doesn't justify punishment for apostasy, then why do so many Muslims believe it's a criminal offense?
You have to remember the Quran is there to give us, as Muslims, the source of our faith. But the Quran in itself doesn't tell us how to do the application of the laws. So, for example, the Quran says that one should hold fast to their prayers. It doesn't say how many prayers, it doesn't say how to pray the prayers. And we get a lot of these things from the hadith. And therein lies the ambiguity, for want of a better word. It's the interpretation of the hadiths, the hadiths being the sayings and the actions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that are open to interpretation.
Haris Rafiq takes a liberal interpretation of the hadith, the sayings and actions of the Prophet Muhammad. So why have others taken a more hardline approach?
Within Islam right now, there's a struggle going on for the very soul of Islam. And some particular groups have decided that they'll go back to 200 years ago when there was a new ideology that was invented that would reject the ideas and the practices of the majority of the Muslims at the time. And I hasten to add the majority of the Muslims right now as well.
And that form of Islam was?
Well, some people call it different names. It was actually created by a chap called Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. So Wahhabi is sometimes what it's referred to. And there have been derivatives and strains of that along the way. Salafism is another neo-form of Wahhabism, if you like. And there's been a shift in power to people who are of that particular viewpoint. And I think there's also an increasing amount of literature coming from people who would want to portray this extreme, literalist, conservative, call it whatever you want, branch of the faith that has flooded our shores.
Haris is clear. The austere form of Islam practiced in Saudi Arabia, known as Wahhabism or Salafism, is to blame. Some of his points resonate with me. I grew up in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, where they have the death penalty for apostasy, and I always thought the issue was unambiguous and clear-cut. And just a few weeks ago, an eminent sheikh there issued a fatwa saying two Saudi writers should be tried for apostasy and put to death if they didn't repent. Their crime was to say that adherents of other faiths should be regarded as believers. So how do they justify such draconian punishments if the Quran doesn't? To find out, I went to meet Abu Khadija, a straight-talking Wahhabi who runs an Islamic bookstore in Birmingham.
The reasons why the Islamic ruling is so severe is because in an Islamic nation, the rulership itself is a theocracy, so it's a religious state. So therefore, if someone renegades, then he doesn't renegade against a monarch, or against the president, or against the parliament, or against democracy. He is renegading, or he is being treasonous towards the sovereign, the sovereignty of God. So we don't really see it as a hugely controversial issue. I know it's become controversial now, but to the Muslim who truly believes, then there are legislations and rulings that remain eternally, and they will remain up until, you know, we perish and the world itself perishes.
What is the method then by which you would execute someone in this particular case?
As far as I'm aware, there is nothing that is specifically textually reported about the method of execution. So in a lot of situations similar to this, where an execution is necessitated, then you'll find that it is discretionary according to the judge. So if the judge decides that this is the best way of execution, maybe a beheading or a hanging, like, you know, what takes place in some countries, or he is banished from the land, or he is crucified, it's left to the discretion of the judge. However, making it clear, executions or punishments or imprisonments or banishments are to be carried out by the state and by the government, and not to be handed out by the hands of individuals or vigilantes or anything other than that. To do that is a major sin.
Abu Khadija's unapologetic defense for the death penalty for apostates, an idea so at odds with our liberal society, is remarkable. He pointed me towards two sayings attributed to the Prophet, which he says justify his position. The Prophet Muhammad apparently said, "Whoever changes his religion, then execute him." And apparently, the Prophet also said, "The blood of a Muslim is not permissible except in one of three cases: a soul for a soul, i.e. murder; a married person who fornicates, i.e. adultery; and the one who abandons his religion, departing from the body of Muslims, i.e. apostasy." Abu Khadija also told me that all the major schools of Islamic law, known as madhabs, agree that the penalty for a male apostate should be death. This surprised me because most Muslims tend to follow the rulings of these schools, even the Sufis, thought to be the most moderate Muslim group. So I went to meet them, this time at a spiritual gathering in West London.
This is dhikr, dhikr Allah. It's very traditional, reciting certain chapters of the Quran, and also then to recite the attributes and names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The love for Allah creates this energy which draws you in to remembering Allah, and when it catches you, it never really wants to let go of you.
Like most Wahhabis, Abu Hadija would object to almost everything about this Sufi group, seeing it as a sinful innovation. For over an hour, worshippers sat in a pitch-black room, reciting verses from the Quran together and chanting Allah's name. The members of this gathering are anything but extreme, and meet in a church hall for their weekly dhikr session. I even heard Nadim, the leader of this Sufi group, saying a prayer for the health of the Queen. What did he think about apostasy?
As far as we understand of what is taught to us through our Sheikh's teachings and also through the holy books, there is no such thing as a death penalty for any act which means that you are having to leave Islam, because who is anybody to punish that person except Allah for the act that that person may take? Not a human being.
There is a hadith which says there are three instances in which it's acceptable to take another Muslim's life, and one of those instances is where someone leaves the faith.
There is certain condition which this applies in, and that's in a state of war, when the person has left and then he's fighting against you. Alhamdulillah, we're not in a state of war, so therefore that condition doesn't apply now.
Would it be a treason today if a Muslim joined, for example, MI5 and was working to investigate Muslim terror cells planning terrorist attacks in Britain?
No. The reason why is because our Shaykh, Allah bless him, he says we don't believe in terrorism. Terrorism is something which is a misunderstanding in the people's minds that follow that kind of route. So therefore, treason is not a matter to even discuss.
This was all in sharp contrast to the sort of anti-British rhetoric I'd absorbed in my days in the radical group Hizb ut-Tahrir. Nadim's understanding is shaped by his spiritual guide, Sheikh Nazim, who's based in Cyprus. But another member of the prayer group, Sajid, follows a different Sufi sheikh from North Africa. Like Nadim, he was keen to stress respect for British law, but what was his view on the Sharia's approach towards apostasy?
The Sharia says that basically anyone who apostates is given the sword. Now, the conditions to that, and one of them is the Sharia's there, that they're given the chance to repent, that they're told what it is they're doing, and the conditions to it.
But after those conditions, after all those conditions were met, if you'd spoken to this person and so on, if they still decided that they wanted to, for example, be an atheist, would there be a death penalty in your opinion for them?
It's not my opinion, it's what the Islamic law says, and they are tough rules. But those rules were there where God-fearing judges existed, and they would find excuses for people to be in jail. I'll give you a quick example here. Islam says if someone does so-and-so, stone him to death. You must have heard that. You know, people know, yeah, wow, it sounds barbaric. Fine. But what does it actually say if you look carefully? Dig a pit, put him in a pit, and throw stones at him. If he or she leaves the pit, leave him alone. You got to understand the context in it and the mercy of it. The mercy is this. If the person thinks, I can't take this punishment, and he tries to climb out, fine, let him go. Because at the end of the day, the only real punishment is from Allah.
I just left the Sufi zikr session, and what's most interesting about that is we've heard a lot about the Sufis being the more moderate voice within Islam, which they certainly are, but even amongst them there was a difference of opinion between some people who suggested that there is a death penalty in certain circumstances, but that we should favour God's mercy. And others who said that there's no death penalty applicable at all for anyone who chooses to leave Islam. And it shows just how nuanced this debate really is. I was starting to realise a lot of this depends on which scholar you follow. Apart from the Sufis and Wahhabis, another important branch of Islam is represented by the Diobandis. They're particularly important in Britain because they run some of the country's biggest mosques and a series of residential colleges aimed at training British-born imams, something the government is very keen on. None of the leading Diobandi imams we approached were willing to appear in this programme, although they're not quite so reserved about expressing their opinions on the internet. You can get so many fatwas online these days that some people say the Grand Mufti of Britain is Sheikh Google. I'm on a website at the moment called muftisays.com, and in response to a question about apostasy, they say that there's unanimous consensus among the jurists that the penalty is death. Now, this fatwa doesn't even include any of the caveats that we heard earlier from Abu Hadija or Sajid, where they say that the punishment should only be carried out, for example, in an Islamic state. And the guy who wrote this fatwa, he teaches jurisprudence at one of the Diobandi colleges in Britain. Now, that's not to say that all Diobandi imams in Britain support this view, but it does go against the idea that the government says we should have more British-trained imams and that that is somehow going to counter extremism.
When you have an agreement in Islamic law, in the Ijma', it's something that cannot be sort of just taken off the books.
Dr. Hisham Hellier is a fellow of the Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies at the University of Oxford and has researched classical Islamic law.
The classical punishments can be, you know, suspended under certain circumstances, commuted under circumstances, even theoretically inapplicable, right, in a practical sort of sense. But it can't simply be taken off the books, because that is tantamount to your saying that all of the authorities that came before you that agreed in such, you know, massive terms were wrong and misguided, and that you're suddenly better, and that you suddenly have more knowledge, which is not the case. The case is only that the circumstances have changed. So the idea is that if they were in this time, they would also alter how they express that understanding, but that the understanding remains the same.
So in a way, are you, to use a sort of almost crude analogy, but is Islam like a common law system of its own, that it does adapt, it does change, it has a basic structure and framework, but that framework and structure is interpreted through the paradigms of the moment, the environment?
The moment is definitely something to be referred to. It's not the only thing to be referred to, because Islamic law does not simply surrender to circumstance, but it also doesn't ignore that circumstances change. Islamic law isn't stagnant. It doesn't require some sort of reformation exercise in order for it to update itself. The updating process is constant, and the only thing that stops it is when the jurists stop learning law or stop learning what the world around them is actually doing.
Most Muslims would agree with Hisham Hellier's view that Islam is renewing itself within a modern context. One of the most eminent traditional scholars alive today, the Chief Mufti of Egypt, Ali Jummah, recently said the death penalty doesn't apply to apostates, but to sedition. According to him, the correct understanding of the hadith mentioning execution is that the Prophet was speaking about those who try to subvert the state through treason. That's a taste of how Sunni Islam is trying to reconcile the past with modernity. But what about Shia Islam and its relationship with the Iranian state?
The Islamic Republic of Iran has reiterated the irrevocable and inalterable death decree of the late Imam Khomeini against Salman Rushdie, the apostate writer of the book Satanic Verses.
Ayatollah Khomeini's famous fatwa on Salman Rushdie's life is still renewed annually by the Iranian regime and announced on the country's radio service. In Iran's case, not only do we have a Muslim leader calling for the death penalty in the modern age, but the target of that fatwa was someone living in Britain. I wanted to find out how a Shia jurist, an expert in Islamic law, thought something like the Rushdie fatwa could be justified.
Yusuf al-Khoi with
Benazir
Bhutto. This is Joe Major.
To get an answer, I didn't need to travel far. In the London suburb of Queen's Park is the Al-Khoi Foundation, housed in a former synagogue in an unassuming back street. But don't let that fool you. This centre is a hub for world leaders, and anyone who wants to do business with the Shia community comes here.
And this is Kofi Annan. This is the Emir of Kuwait.
Inside their atrium, Dr. Faisal Milani, one of their scholars, showed me walls lined with photographs of visiting dignitaries. One of the ways that Shia scholarship differs from Sunni Islam is that in addition to looking at the Quran and Hadith for sources of law, they also place an extra emphasis on the descendants of the Prophet, known as the Ahlul Bayt, who they regard as infallible. They are known as the infallible Imams, none of whom are alive today.
Anyone who rejects the tenets of Islam, he will be considered as apostate. And the punishment for apostasy is clear in the Quran, the Hadith, all agree on that.
Could you tell us what that punishment is in your opinion?
Yeah, the punishment is execution. But who is going to apply that type of punishment? Here is the difference between Shias and Sunnis. According to the Shias, only the infallible Imam, only those Imams have the right to apply this type of punishment on people. Not ordinary judge in the court, not the emir or the jurist or clerics.
In the state of Iran then, Khomeini said he would establish the guardianship of the jurists. Are you saying even in that situation then that those jurists would be unable to take the decision as to executing an apostate?
Yeah. Ayatollah Khomeini said that in his opinion, yes, such a person can exercise all those punishments. The majority of Shia fuqaha or the jurists do not believe and do not support the theory unconditionally.
So just to be very clear, you're saying that there is a death penalty for apostasy within Islam, but that...
Theoretically. But how to practice it, there is a difference amongst the jurists about it.
This was similar to the view I heard from Sajid, the Sufi who favoured mercy, but said that such a tough punishment can't be repealed. Both he and Milani agree with the more conventional Wahhabi notion about the death penalty, but don't believe there is any worldly authority who can actually carry it out. What Milani says means a Rushdie fatwa would be regarded as unworkable by the majority of Shia scholars today. It's becoming clear to me that apostasy in Islam isn't just a theological debate. It's about the political context in which Islam finds itself. According to Professor Anne Elizabeth Mayer, an expert on Islamic law in Middle Eastern societies, it's a subject that was hardly even talked about until relatively recently.
I think the fact that we're talking about apostasy now, when we weren't talking about apostasy in Islam many decades ago, tells us that something has been building up that has really changed the significance of this crime.
Looking at the sort of rise of this phenomena in more recent times, do you think this is more reflective of how the Muslim world, particularly in a political context, is seeing itself now?
Yes, I think that probably is what is at issue now. We've got enormous stress on these societies. The process of globalization has not turned out well for them. And you have societies that have a very nervous sense of not matching up to the rival civilization, at least the one they typically think as their rival, the Western civilization. And it seems rather natural, I think, for many people in this context to try to establish some kind of Islamic legitimacy that gives them a sense that they are in the right in some sense.
In this post 9/11 world that we live in, there is a strong understanding of polarization.
Christian convert Zia Miral has been researching attitudes towards apostasy in the Muslim world for a report to be published by Christian Solidarity Worldwide.
I don't believe in clash of civilization, but within this narrative of us versus them, the crusade against evil imagery, the civilized world fighting against the terrorists, and the world of Islam trying to defend itself against the crusaders, then all of a sudden you're seen as betraying your community, your nation.
And through your work, are you finding that other people who are choosing to renounce Islam are also being thought of as betrayers or traitors to their society in some kind of way.
Definitely. I spent the whole year actually doing interviews in Iran, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, Turkey and the UK with those who left Islam for another religion, particularly Christian faith. All of them, in all of this context, they verbalize the same things. Their governments list them as national threat, thus limit their employments in the civil service, fire them from jobs, block their rights for grants, scholarship, deny their access to fair justice, and also in some cases you can be detained and tortured, lose your identification cards, your passport, your marriage can be annulled, you can lose your rights over your children, your custody rights and your inheritance rights.
Although state-sanctioned persecution is common, in Ziya's survey of apostasy laws in the Islamic world, he says only 5 Muslim countries, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Sudan, Mauritania and Malaysia, have the death penalty for apostasy, and even then, it's almost never used, partly because of international pressure. But it is worrying that almost every Muslim I've spoken to has categorically refused to say the death penalty for apostasy is wrong. There seems to be an idea that it's theoretically okay and it could be revived in a perfect Islamic state. Could I find a scholar who's prepared to tell me that it couldn't and it's not okay?
The scholars and the jurists, they were often in their own world, really, discussing all the theoretical issues, which had very little bearing on the real world. So, for example, the other hadith which said, whoever changes his or her religion, kill them. One of the school, the Shafi'i school, went as far as to say, this hadith is general and applies to any apostate from any religion. It applies to a Jew becoming a Christian or vice versa, but not if they're becoming Muslim. And this is an obvious fallacy which shows how even the great classical schools can get it wrong. You know, this is ridiculous, basically.
Osama Hassan is a trained scholar, and precisely the kind of guy you might expect to be a hardliner. Brought up in a Salafi household during the 1980s, while studying physics at Cambridge University, he went to fight jihad in Afghanistan and arranged for plenty of other Muslims to follow suit. But he's no longer wedded to a dogmatic interpretation of Islam and says examining the wording of the Quran and the Hadith are the most important thing.
I do believe that the classical law of apostasy in Islam is wrong and based on a misunderstanding of the original sources, because the Quran and the teaching of the Prophet basically don't talk about a death penalty for apostasy. So it's very easy to argue, actually, that in a time when the Muslims were under constant attack from the polytheists, when the Prophet said somebody leaves their religion and abandons the community, that's talking about something very similar to treason in a state of war.
In terms of your own journey, I mean, what led you to adopt a softer view on this particular issue?
I have to say it's the Quran itself. I was fortunate to, you know, memorize the entire Quran by the age of 10-11, so that means for the last quarter of a century or more I've been reciting the Quran every day and studying it constantly, and it's still my favorite subject. And there are certain rules in the Quran which are quite clear. One is, for example, alcohol is a very bad idea, it's forbidden. Gambling is a bad idea, it's forbidden. Pork, you don't eat pork. But other issues, many Muslims over the centuries have made into equivalent fundamentals without any basis. And I'd include things like the headscarf, the beard, you know, people argue for hours over these things. Music, musical instruments. There is no verse in the Quran prescribing a death penalty for apostates. That's so clear. There is for a murderer. That's very clear also. Death penalty for murder. But there isn't one for apostasy. And to me, it's always taught to go back to the Quran. That is ultimately God's revelation. And so that, I think that truth just shines through.
Well-meaning moderates say that the death penalty was only ever meant to apply to those guilty of apostasy and treason. The problem is that for a tiny and dangerous minority, being guilty of treason towards a Muslim community is in itself an act of apostasy, and their definition of treason is a broad one.
The dead and injured were all police cadets, training for duty on Iraq's dangerous streets.
In the new Iraq, doing anything that could be considered as aiding the British or American troops is regarded as treason. And that can include even the smallest things like joining the police force or working as an interpreter.
A woman hiding a belt of explosives under her black robe blew herself up among a crowd of people queuing at a police recruiting center.
This attitude comes from a part of Al-Qaeda's ideology that says you can kill Muslims who support or integrate with the West. It's a minority view, but they would say that by not supporting their political agenda, you're an apostate and a traitor. This is what made the beheading plot in Birmingham a real turning point. Whereas conventional acts of terrorism, like bombings, are indiscriminate and threaten us all. The beheading plot was specifically aimed at Muslims who were regarded as being moderates or sellouts. I wanted to ask Hisham Helia what classical Islam says about this political interpretation.
There was a plot recently in Birmingham where guys had planned to kidnap and behead a Muslim soldier because they regarded that as treason to the Muslim community. If a Muslim joined the British Army, that's enough to constitute treason to the Muslim community.
Treason isn't against the community, treason is against the state. And I'm not sure which state the British Muslims that were in the army were actually committing treason against.
Well, it's interesting because you're saying actually the Islamic definition of treason is treason against the state you're in, whereas the extremist interpretation of the people, for example, who are going to carry out the beheading, in their notion, treason isn't against the state, it's against the Ummah, the community of Islam. That argument would seem to be out of kilter with orthodox opinion, as far as you know.
I'll be honest, though, I don't think that they were particularly interested in orthodox opinion, because for one thing, under all systems of law, whether orthodox or otherwise, I fail to understand how somebody could be guilty of apostasy in this case, but maybe they have an argument for it. But even if they do, Muslims cannot enact any sort of penal punishment via vigilante means.
On my journey, I've realised this isn't just a religious debate. It's also a political one. If you want to leave the faith and embrace another one, like Sophia and Zia, you can stop being a Muslim. You've got to be pretty brave to try and put up with a lot of hostility, but you can do it. But I now see my exploration of apostasy as a metaphor for the wider struggle within Islam. Is Islam itself a religion or an ideology? For some of those for whom Islam is essentially political, so-called sellout Muslims are apostates, and the extremists have managed to find some theological justification for their view. For them, the penalty for apostasy is clear. It's death.
Could I Stop Being a Muslim was presented by Shiraz Meir. The producer was Innes Bowen.
Take a trip. It's almost never used, partly because of international pressure. But it is worrying that almost every Muslim I've spoken to has categorically refused to say the death penalty for apostasy is wrong. There seems to be an idea that it's theoretically okay and it could be revived in a perfect Islamic state. Could I find a scholar who's prepared to tell me that it couldn't and it's not okay?
The scholars and the jurists, they were often in their own world, really, discussing all these theoretical issues, which had very little bearing on the real world. So, for example, the other hadith which said, whoever changes his or her religion, kill them. One of the schools, the Shafi'i school, went as far as to say, this hadith is general and applies to any apostate from any religion. It applies to a Jew becoming a Christian or vice versa, but not if they're becoming Muslim. And this is an obvious fallacy which shows how even the great classical schools can get it wrong. You know, this is ridiculous, basically.
Osama Hassan is a trained scholar, and precisely the kind of guy you might expect to be a hardliner. Brought up in a Salafi household during the 1980s, while studying physics at Cambridge University, he went to fight jihad in Afghanistan, and arranged for plenty of other Muslims to follow suit. But he's no longer wedded to a dogmatic interpretation of Islam, and says examining the wording of the Quran and the Hadith are the most important thing.
I do believe that the classical law of apostasy in Islam is wrong and based on a misunderstanding of the original sources, because the Quran and the teaching of the Prophet basically don't talk about a death penalty for apostasy. So it's very easy to argue, actually, that in a time when the Muslims were under constant attack from the polytheists, when the Prophet said somebody leaves their religion and abandons the community, that's talking about something very similar to treason in a state of war.
In terms of your own journey, I mean, what led you to adopt a softer view on this particular issue?
I have to say, it's the Quran itself. I was fortunate to, you know, memorize the entire Quran by the age of 10-11, so that means for the last quarter of a century or more, I've been reciting the Quran every day and studying it constantly, and it's still my favorite subject. And there are certain rules in the Quran which are quite clear. One is, for example, alcohol is a very bad idea, it's forbidden. Gambling is a bad idea, it's forbidden. Pork, you don't eat pork. But other issues, many Muslims over the centuries have made into equivalent fundamentals without any basis. And I'd include things like the headscarf, the beard, you know, people argue for hours over these things. Musical instruments. There is no verse in the Quran prescribing a death penalty for apostates. That's so clear. There is for a murderer. That's very clear also. Death penalty for murder. But there isn't one for apostasy, and to me it's always taught to go back to the Quran. That is ultimately God's revelation. And so that I think that truth just shines through.
Well-meaning moderates say that the death penalty was only ever meant to apply to those guilty of apostasy and treason. The problem is that for a tiny and dangerous minority, being guilty of treason towards a Muslim community is in itself an act of apostasy. And their definition of treason is a broad one.
The dead and injured were all police cadets, training for duty on Iraq's dangerous streets.
In the new Iraq, doing anything that could be considered as aiding the British or American troops is regarded as treason. And that can include even the smallest things like joining the police force or working as an interpreter.
A woman hiding a belt of explosives under her black robe blew herself up among a crowd of people queuing at a police recruiting centre.
This attitude comes from a part of Al-Qaeda's ideology that says you can kill Muslims who support or integrate with the West. It's a minority view, but they would say that by not supporting their political agenda, you're an apostate and a traitor. This is what made the beheading plot in Birmingham a real turning point. Whereas conventional acts of terrorism, like bombings, are indiscriminate and threaten us all, the beheading plot was specifically aimed at Muslims who were regarded as being moderates or sellouts. I wanted to ask Hisham Helia what classical Islam says about this political interpretation. There was a plot recently in Birmingham where guys had planned to kidnap and behead a Muslim soldier because they regarded that as treason to the Muslim community. If a Muslim joined the British Army, that's enough to constitute treason to the Muslim community.
Treason isn't against the community, treason is against the state. And I'm not sure which state the British Muslims that were in the army were actually committing treason against.
Well, it's interesting because you're saying actually the Islamic definition of treason is treason against the state you're in, whereas the extremist interpretation of the people, for example, who are going to carry out the beheading, in their notion, treason isn't against the state, it's against the Ummah, the community of Islam. That argument would seem to be out of kilter with orthodox opinion, as far as you know.
I'll be honest, though, I don't think that they were particularly interested in orthodox opinion, because for one thing, under all systems of law, whether orthodox or otherwise, I fail to understand how somebody could be guilty of apostasy in this case, but maybe they have an argument for it. But even if they do, Muslims cannot enact any sort of penal punishment via vigilante means.
On my journey, I've realized this isn't just a religious debate. It's also a political one. If you want to leave the faith and embrace another one, like Safiya and Zia, you can stop being a Muslim. You've got to be pretty brave to try and put up with a lot of hostility, but you can do it. But I now see my exploration of apostasy as a metaphor for the wider struggle within Islam. Is Islam itself a religion or an ideology? For some of those for whom Islam is essentially political, so-called sellout Muslims are apostates, and the extremists have managed to find some theological justification for their view. For them, the penalty for apostasy is clear. It's death.
Could I Stop Being a Muslim was presented by Shiraz Mayer. The producer was Innes Bowen. Take a trip.